Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to those who've made it here tonight at our person-to-person function, and also those, some of whom live outside of Sydney, who are on our web tonight, and I think that includes Geoffrey Blaney, so welcome to Geoffrey and others. Now, I'll just be very brief in the introduction. Margaret Cameron-Ash makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here a few years ago talking on an earlier book. But today, on the occasion of the very recent release of Beating France to Botany Bay, The Race to Found Australia.
Well, it's nice to be back at the Sydney Institute. And thank you for inviting me, Anne and Gerard. And thank you for coming tonight. And those watching at home. Since speaking to you about lying for the Admiralty, I'm happy to report that it's on the CIA reading list. A senior analyst at the CIA called Robert Clark has published a book called Geospatial Intelligence, Origins and Evolution, in which he cites my book in the context of Cook's patriotic fake maps. Now, it's funny when you're young, you accept some things that on the face of it don't really make sense. But you keep on accepting it until someone gives it a shake. Now, a sailor gave me a shake several years ago. He said that he had been in several Sydney to Hobart races, and he couldn't understand why Cook, when he was in Bass Strait in 1770, didn't discover Bass Strait, didn't realise it was a strait. And there he was in the Roaring Forties. That spurred me to investigate, and I've been asking questions ever since. Now, tonight I'll look at some of the highlights that I've found in this new and forgotten evidence. Now, we'll start at the end of the story due to matters arising in Glasgow earlier this year. I want to assure Mr. Macron that Australia has enjoyed a very warm entente cordiale with France since the dawn of modern Australia. In 1788, as soon as Governor Philip moved into his portable canvas government house at Sydney Cove, he immediately hosted a vice-regal reception for Rear Admiral La Perouse, who was then camping down in Botany Bay. As reported by Arthur Bowes-Smythe, the surgeon on the Lady Penrhyn, Philip sent two horses to Botany Bay to collect La Perouse and his friends. The following day, the four Frenchmen arrived. It was Wednesday, the 20th of February, and they stayed for two nights, returning to Botany Bay on the Friday. I don't know if Philip uttered those immortal words, Captain La Perouse, I presume, but this has to be one of the most famous meetings in history. We'll now cross to London for the beginning of the story. Cook made his Australian discoveries about 16 years earlier, but nothing had been done about them. Joseph Banks and a few others wanted the government to occupy Australia, and which was the only way of getting a proper title to the place. At two parliamentary inquiries in 1779 and 1785, Banks suggested sending an occupation force consisting of convicts or American loyalists or both. At each time, His suggestion was ignored, and Botany Bay was soon forgotten. A Pacific colony was just too difficult, both financially and politically. Then suddenly, out of nowhere, an emergency cabinet meeting was called for Friday, the 18th of August, 1786, the magic date. It ran for 30 hours, and at midday on Saturday, a dispatch rider was sent to Windsor to tell George III he would soon be reigning over an empire in the South Seas. So what triggered this? One is reminded of John Kennedy in 1961. When he, or before he got to the White House, Kennedy was pretty much against space investigations. He thought they were a waste of money, a waste of time. But then there was Yuri Gagarin, and forced Kennedy to announce within 6 weeks that he'd have a man on the moon before the end of the decade. Now, something similar happened in 1786. Who threw that bombshell on Thursday, the 17th of August, that triggered the cabinet meeting the following day? After several years of research, I realised that it was John Ledyard, the brilliant and entertaining man from Connecticut, who had sailed with Cook on his third voyage, then went to Paris, where he became a close friend of the American ambassador there, Thomas Jefferson. Now, in mid-1875, Jefferson, like many others, was worried about the hidden purpose of the imminent French expedition to the Pacific under the command of La Perouse. Jefferson didn't want any French colonies on his American west coast. So he asked the American, previously Scottish, naval officer John Paul Jones, who was also in France, to spy on the French port of Brest, where La Perouse's ships were being loaded. Jones did an excellent job. He wrote a detailed letter to Jefferson. In brief, he said that Jefferson was instructed to claim possession in two areas. He was to build a seasonal base near Alaska for French fur traders, and he was also told to establish colonies in New Holland. Jefferson was perplexed, and so he showed the letter to his friend John Ledyard, who was the only man in Paris who had visited both New Holland, it was Tasmania actually, and Alaska. After Ledyard had read the letter, he told Jefferson not to worry. There would be no permanent French colonies in America. They were going to be established in Australia. Jefferson was relieved, and that could have been the end of the matter. But now we fast forward 10 months to early August 1786. Ledyard is still in Paris, where he meets the Marquess of Buckingham, the first cousin of the Prime Minister, William Pitt. Buckingham recruits Ledyard to head a gun-running operation to help the Spanish colonies in South America rebel against metropolitan Spain. This is a very funny story. The ship transporting the weapons is leaving the Thames on Friday, the 18th of August. So Ledyard rushes to London after asking poor Thomas Jefferson for yet another loan. Now, Ledyard arrives in London around the 12th of August, and by Wednesday, the 16th of August, he has spent the money on two dogs, a tomahawk, and a peace pipe. On Thursday, the 17th of August, he meets Joseph Banks, with whom he has much in common because both men sailed with Cook. And Banks is always keen to meet another Cook alumni. Now, it has always been thought that Banks was not in London at the time of the Botany Bay decision because, like most wealthy Londoners, in summer, he escaped the city and he was now down at his villa near Kew Gardens. However, Banks was a clubbable man and always enjoyed a dinner party. So I fossicked about in the Royal Society archives and found that on Thursday the 17th of August, Banks, as always, joined his friends at the Crown and Anchor pub in the Strand for the weekly meeting of the Royal Society Dining Club. The Royal Society proper had closed for the summer vacation, but the dining club met all year round. I've included a photo of the dining club register in the book. The club rules stated that the dinner had to begin at 4:30 p.m. So there was plenty of time for the two Cook alumni to meet, which they probably did at Banks's house at 32 Soho Square. Here Banks, the charmer, and Ledyard, the show-off, probably spent an hour or two together, reminiscing about their old Pacific voyages and then discussed the prospects of the new French voyage under La Perouse. Ledyard would have boasted about his friendship with Jefferson and the letter written by John Paul Jones. Banks was flabbergasted when he heard that the proposed French colonies were going to be established in New Holland. But he was also very thrilled. He would have extracted from Ledyard all the information he could. Then as soon as Ledyard had left the house for his ship, Banks called his carriage and raced across to Whitehall to tell William Pitt. Immediately, the cabinet meeting was called for the following morning, and history followed. So I'll move on to another highlight, which is why Arthur Phillip instructed to claim half the continent when Cook's purported claim was just the narrow coastal strip. The western boundary of Phillip's claim stretched right across to latitude 135 east, which is almost as far as Alice Springs. It was an audacious and outrageous claim, and the British government, of course, never attempted to explain or justify this claim, so we're left to guess why they did it. In 1914, Frederick Watson, an historian, suggested that the reason was that Whitehall was worried about the presence of La Perouse in the Pacific, and I think that's mostly correct. But in about the mid-1980s, some scholars developed an unrelated theory that had nothing to do with France. They said that Whitehall was being guided by the ancient Torcedillas Treaty, agreed between Spain and Portugal in 1492, so very ancient, when it was blessed by the Pope. They go on to say that the anti-meridian of the Tordesillas line is the demarcation line on that beautiful map of Australia drawn by the English cartographer Emmanuel Bowen in 1747. It was the only real map just of Australia before Cook. Now, I think this is just a romantic story. For one thing, Queen Elizabeth I said that the Tordesillas Treaty had certainly nothing to do with England, and the Bishop of Rome certainly had no jurisdiction over her or her country, and he had no right to tell her where her ships could go. And so that was sort of that. The King of France said much the same thing. He was Catholic, of course, and he was very upset that the Pope had omitted him from the treaty presence. For another thing, when you compare it with your school atlas, you see that the line on Emmanuel Bowen's map does not run down longitude 135 at all. It runs down longitude 136, which is far too far east for the strategists in Whitehall. Now, one may think that 1 degree difference is neither here nor there, as there's only 67 miles between these two longitudes. But in fact, there was much more. There was the zigzag western shore of the Gulf of Carpentaria, containing a plethora of river mouths. Now, any one of those river mouths could be the entrance to the imagined channel running from the Gulf of Carpentaria to the Great Australian Bight, dividing the continent into two large islands. This imagined transcontinental channel or strait was one of the three main strategic jewels that Britain really wanted in Australia. The other two were Port Jackson and the insula Tasmania. Cook had found both of these and had quickly concealed them until they could be protected with garrisons. Now, returning to the western shores of the Gulf, consider the mighty Roper River, which could be the entrance to the mythical channel, if you're sitting in Whitehall. That river discharges into Lemon Bight, named after Abel Tasman's flagship. And it lies, Lemon Bight lies on the western side, the Dutch side, of the line on Emmanuel Bowen's map. This was no good for Whitehall. La Perouse could claim possession and control of that river mouth, enter the mythical channel, sail south to Adelaide, and claim for France the western half of the now bisected continent. So Whitehall ignored Bowen's map. Instead, they shifted westward, well away from the waters of the jagged shoreline and into the dry land of the Northern Territory, where they drew the new Anglo-Dutch border at 135 degrees east. Now, I interrupt these highlights to say that it would be wonderful to see this Anglo-French story added to the school curriculum when children are taught the story of modern Australia. There are many threads to that story, and Anglo-French rivalry is only one of them. But it's the thread that tells us why it all happened. It's also a rip-roaring yarn. The Battle of Port Jackson was possibly the most significant naval victory in the era of Anglo-French rivalry. The Battle of Trafalgar in 1805 has received the most glorification of any naval battle in history. But while it boosted morale, it decided almost nothing. It did not prevent the invasion of England because Napoleon had abandoned that plan months earlier, and it did not end the Napoleonic Wars, which raged for another 10 years. The Battle of Port Jackson received no glorification, but Arthur Phillip's victory gave this country the evolving parliamentary democracy of England instead of the absolutist monarchy of France. Arthur Phillip's victory also shaped the history of Eastern Australia. Now, there are many other issues that didn't really make sense in school. For example, why was the First Fleet sent to Botany Bay if it was Port Jackson that they wanted? Or why was the French government writing new instructions for La Perouse and sent them across the courier, by courier across Siberia? Why did La Perouse sail past the tempting Sydney Heads on his way south from Broken Bay? However, there's not time to do all of that, and so I'll just answer your questions if you have them.
Sorry, I just got a cough. So many thanks for that talk. We've got plenty of time for questions and discussion. And as I should have said earlier, the copies of Beating France to Botany Bay, The Race to Found Australia, are on sale tonight, and they'll be on sale online as well, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them. And I got a quick response out of Canberra today. I said, what's the Prime Minister's response to the book Beating France to Botany Bay? And the answer was, thank God. And not Dieu merci. And so we come to a discussion. So what's all this about? Is it Australia? Is it the Great Southland? Is it New Holland? And how do we get into these kind of arguments? Because I was talking about the Great Southland and I was told I was wrong.
By you earlier. Yes.
I'm sorry. So tell us.
Well, the Great Southland refers to the imagined, the land the Greeks imagined, Terra Australis Incognita. It's actually south, which is not what... Australia isn't even the second southern land. It's about the third, I think, if not the fourth. It was called Terra Australis Incognita, and as I say in my first book, it was actually... The word Australia actually appears on several maps around about 1600s, 1700s, on Antarctica, as it was then called. It was Australia. And what they thought was it was much bigger, and the reason they wanted it was they thought that at least some of its peninsulas would reach up into the Pacific when people could live there and buy English cardigans. But no one in the 18th century confused it with New Holland. New Holland had been found in the 1600s. It had been circumnavigated by Tasman. Everybody knew it was there, and it had the name New Holland, just as another country has the name New Zealand. But after settlement in Australia, for some reason, Flinders and his friends, or Macquarie or someone, decided that we didn't want to be New Hollanders. They're perfectly happy being New Zealanders, but we had to have a name change. And so we pinched Australia from Antarctica and put it there. And that left Antarctica without a name for about 80 years. People tried to think, it had to end in A for Latin reasons, and people thought of Ultima and all sorts of things. And in the end, they just put an A on Antarctic. And we don't have an Arctica, and we didn't have an Antarctica, but now we do. The poor thing was nameless for about 80 years. Tasmania was discovered, and I think Tasman knew it was separate, I have to say, because when he tried to get around Eddystone Point, he couldn't get round. He was just blown out and off the map, literally. But he wasn't telling anyone, just like Cook subsequent. And I think that Cook guessed that that is what had happened to Tasman, just from reading his journal. And he wanted to prove it, and so he did prove it, and then he quickly turned the ship back, saying no one saw anything, did they? And just kept on going north.
So, Anne, I'll just...
Margaret, we're having this debate about, you know, the sort of issue that Jared was talking about, whether we call it Australia and we have to... our First Nation people have their say and whatever. What was the mentality around these men of London, these men of wherever Perouse came from, La Perouse came from, that they could sort of look at the globe and think that they could have it if they got there? I mean, it's a totally different mentality from today when we have all of the world mapped and we see different levels of ownership. Mm. Tell us about that mentality, because you compared it with the space travel.
Yes, yeah.
It's a different mentality entirely. Mm. And
well, we hope it is.
It was there and no one was there, you know, terra nullius or whatever we call it. Give us an insight into how they saw their right to do this and the achievements that they planned with it.
I think from the Spanish and the Portuguese onwards, I think they genuinely thought it wasn't so much as taking something, it was giving something. They were bringing God, they were bringing writing, and a whole lot of other things. And Cook and Arthur Phillip were well aware that there was no terra nullius, there were people there, and they both spoke about them. Phillip in particular was very concerned about their welfare. And he said, I'll keep them separate from the convicts because we don't want them contaminated by the convicts. And and all this sort of thing. After Australia, there was the scramble for Africa, of course, and then everyone went nutty, and Germany unified and got in on the game. And so they had a big conference, I think, in the late 1800s, where they made rules about who could take what. And I think it all sort of got itself sorted out then. And it's now just a completely different attitude. But I think that they did think they were benefiting the countries, although I have to say that when Cook was approaching New Zealand on his second voyage, I think he said something along the lines of, I hope they don't settle here. I hope Europeans don't settle here because look what they've done to America, and which was an interesting notion.
We look at the whole scene now from the 21st century and what we know, as Anne said, about the whole globe, etc. What were the French, apart from beating the Poms, what were the French hoping to get out of getting down to Australia? Because I don't know, were they thinking they might find all sorts of new wealth down here? Or what was the mentality? I mean, the Poms had a definite reason for coming down here, you know, as a landing place for a whole heap of convicts and maybe a few other things. But were there any tangible other ideas, reason for the French wanting to get down here and grab this new land down south?
After their dreadful loss in the Seven Years' War, when they lost Canada in particular, they were keen to have a southern hemisphere. They thought, we've lost the north, we'll go for the south. We'll try and get something in the southern hemisphere. I don't think anyone thought Australia had tremendous wealth. They really only had reports about the West, and all its wealth was hidden underground. They probably wanted a base. By the time they got to La Perouse, he was actually not told to go up the East Coast because Cook had done that. Whether or not they accepted the claim of possession, I don't know, but they were looking in particular at Tasmania and the land between Adelaide and Melbourne, which they did at one stage name Terra Napoleon. I think Britain didn't want it. You know, the convicts were a cover. They were a very useful critical mass of occupiers, which is what you want. And when you're trying to shift people, as Stalin and others have found, you've either got to have refugees or you've got to have prisoners, because nobody else wants to go. And you want a travel-ready group of people who just will do, and preferably will do what you want at the point of a gun, which you had the power to do with convicts, not so much with the American loyalists. And you see, they could have split ranks. That's what happened with several of the American colonies. They perished because the leadership divided. So the convicts were terrific, and you got your cheap labour, and everything. But the convict thing had been put up, as I say, in 1779 and 1785, and it was thrown out the window. It was too expensive. And more importantly, it was politically impossible because of the East India Company. And they had other solutions for the convicts. In 1779, they passed the Penitentiary Act. They were going to build Club Med all around the country and send the prisoners there to repent and become useful people.
The encounter between La Perouse and Arthur Phillip is deliciously enticing in terms of speculation about what they talked about. I note in your book you speculate, and I don't say that critically, that Phillip may have banned his colleagues from writing about the encounter in their journals. Can you talk a little more about what sources you do have about the meeting, and in particular, did you look at the French sources to see if what was reported on their side, recorded on their side?
I'll speak about the French first. I'm sure an awful lot was recorded, but it went down with their ships. Unfortunately, La Perouse had a rule that when you're in a port, you can write about that port, but you won't send it from that port, you'll send it from the next port. He did this all through his trip, and it was a tragedy that that happened in Sydney, because it would have been wonderful to have heard what they thought about the about Sydney, which no Frenchman got to before they sent their last letters. Those letters were all dated, well, the latest date was the 7th of February, when they still had a month to run, and they still had to visit Sydney. The box of letters was taken around to Philip on the 8th of February. Why a second box wasn't sent about 3 or 4 weeks later, I don't think it was Philip who stopped that. I think it was La Perouse just not wanting... I think La Perouse was probably right. I think the British probably would have read it. But even so, it would have been nice to have the letters. So that's why there's no French report on that visit. As to the British reports, there is quite a lot. There's Beau Smythe saying he sent two horses across to Botany Bay to collect the Commodore and his suite. Well, that's pretty real. Then you have William Bradley reports the Frenchmen, four Frenchmen have arrived at the governor's, for the governor, today. Then you have wonderful Ralph Clark, who says, well, he writes about them three times. He says, they've arrived today, and then one of them, Abby Mongay, he calls on Clark to inspect his insect collection, and then he calls on Clark again on the Friday morning and says, please, may I have a grasshopper? And Clark writes to his wife, I couldn't give him the grasshopper because I'm saving it for you. Now, that's almost as much as we get directly. Clark also says, and the Frenchman left this morning back for Botany Bay. We also have a lot of indirect evidence. Collins, Hunter, and Philip himself say things, have conversations with La Perouse. They say we spoke to La Perouse, that they some of them could have happened at Botany Bay, but most of them didn't. And so that is indirect evidence that it happened.
There's a question here.
Yeah. I'd just like to start by congratulating you first on your first book, which I consider is the most interesting book on Cook published in the last 50 years. But I do have a special plea.
Yes.
And that is, I have a house full of books. My better half has ordained that no extra book can enter the house unless another one leaves. Would it be possible, or could you consider releasing your books on ebook so we could buy a Kindle and have it that way and not contribute to the space in the house?
I think that's probably more a question for the publisher rather than the author.
Could
I
be,
think.
Yes. My main question is...
A brief main question.
Very briefly, it strikes me that you're right on the money with the second book. Would you agree that the meeting with Banks was the straw that broke the camel's back?
Okay.
Would you agree with that?
You mean Ledyard's meeting with Banks?
What I'm saying is... the Committee of Inquiry had plumped for South West Africa, mainly on the basis of lobbying rather than having a good case, but it was too close. They could send the ship Nautilus down there to check it out. And it had come back a month before to say that it wasn't called the Skeleton Coast for nothing. Mm. So the government was really stuck. And then this information...
They weren't.
Okay, got to move on. Yeah, okay.
Sorry. After the Nautilus returned, there was a little more chat about other places in the Atlantic. They did not want to leave the Atlantic because of the East India Company. And it was only when they, Alexander Dalrymple had said, I don't want anything in my precious East India zone except for if France is going to do it. France was going to do it, and that was it. I think it was a single item.
Given the contentious situation at the moment between France and us. I wonder whether you anticipate a big market for your book in France.
Well, a few have made it to England, so maybe someone will send it across the channel. Yes.
So you mentioned briefly in your speech, and this also briefly in your book, New Zealand. Why wasn't there any interest in New Zealand? Is this unfair?
No, it's really the same reason there wasn't any interest in Australia. Britain was literally taken kicking and screaming to settle Australia, and it was the threat of France that did it. And I might add, the same thing happened in New Zealand. Britain did not want New Zealand. It didn't want any more territory. It only wanted trade, no more administration. But the New Zealanders were begging them to take it. They said, no, no, no. And then finally, someone had the sense to say, the French are coming. And they came. Yeah.
Yes, Margaret, there's one interesting story in your book is about two alleged treasure islands in the North Pacific of gold and silver, and they were, as it were, imaginary and fictitious islands, as it turned out, but tempting. To what extent was searching for these two islands a cause of delay to La Perouse?
Well, it certainly delayed him. He should have been, without those islands, he would have been here a month earlier. La Perouse was willing to ditch everything when he got the orders in Kamchatka, except these islands of gold and silver. And he went across the international date line and stayed there for 11 weeks. I think it was a deliberately decoy by the Admiralty. They published a map of Cook's three voyages, and they retained those ancient mythical islands when they knew they weren't there, but that they would be a diversion for anyone else that was crossing the North Atlantic. And the other decoy, of course, was Cook's and the Admiralty's and France's insistence on Botany Bay is where we're going. And that's all we ever know now. We're bound for Botany Bay, but they never were. They were bound for Port Jackson. Botany Bay was only a rendezvous point, but by focusing on that, they got La Perouse to sail past the heads. And if he had turned west, he would have planted his flag there. So, and he could have.
Yeah. You say they didn't want the Great Southland of Britain. It was too expensive or it wasn't in their interest. We didn't get history quite that way when we were being taught it. Yeah. But what was it about the French that made them suddenly decide they had to have it? I mean, what did they suspect the French would do with it? They were obviously suspicious that they weren't just using it for research.
No.
So what, did they think they were going to turn themselves into a new communist China or something?
I'm not terribly sure that the French knew precisely what they'd do with it. France was feeling very buoyant. When the Americans said, will you help us get rid of Britain? They said, sure, we'll. And they had won a war against Britain, and they were feeling terrific. And they thought they'd do a Pacific voyage which would outshine Cook's. And they weren't going to the East Coast, as I say. They were going to try and find the imaginary channel. They were going to go around and they were going to see what the South Coast, which looked as though it was pretty good, the South Coast, and they were going to look at Tasmania. And they were probably just going to set up at a French base, and it was going to be a new French empire, and they'd spread out from there, but that would be their base, just as the Falkland Islands were going to be for a short time.
Well, then, you know, the irony is that because Britain did expand more than France, you know, the empire upon which the sun never set.
Yes.
Britain kind of outdid the French big time in the 19th century. Can you explain that?
The French always had very good ideas. They usually beat the British on ideas. Bougainville beat Cook to Australia and so on. They were not good at execution. They just couldn't. They grabbed defeat from the jaws of victory every time, which was sad.
Sounds familiar. Nothing's changed.
Sad for the French. Well, yes.
Nothing's changed.
Sad for the French. Yes.
Now, in your speech, you made a comment about teaching the way history is taught in schools. So how does that go towards the thesis you're talking about here in your previous talk here about, I mean, what are our children not being taught that they should be taught about these very early settlements and the competition between those two nations?
Well, I think that's it. I mean, my two grandchildren, well, one grandchild is doing... I think he did cook last year, and he's doing the settlement this year. And they have all the predictable things. I mean, the other stories are there's the convict story, there's the indigenous story, there's the environmental story, there's the free settler story, and all of that's terrific. But there are other stories, and one of them is the Anglo-French rivalry, which is actually why we're here, whether we want to be or not. And I think it would be good, and what's more, it's a happy story. We won. I mean, somebody won. It is a good shoot 'em up type story that children would like in the classroom. Do you remember going to sleep in your social studies classes?
I can't remember. I think I dreamt through them.
I rest my case.
probably not, to be clear, but we didn't learn much about the French, but we did learn about the
Indigenous. No, but that's why it should be introduced.
We learned about the Indigenous, although people say we didn't, but we did. Mm. I mean, I did, I don't know, I can't speak for others. But so we're pretty well going to finish now. Have I missed anyone? So in terms of your previous book, which you spoke here about, and since then, the CIA's got interested.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which must be a plus. And now your current book. Mm. What's next?
I think that's it. I think that's it. That's all I have to say.
Well, that's probably a good spot to end on.
Yes.
So many thanks to Margaret Cameron-Ash for an entertaining and informative discussion today, following on her previous talk here about, on this occasion, beating France to Botany Bay, the race to found Australia. And as I said, there are copies available tonight. There are copies available will be on our website when Anne puts it up tomorrow or the next day. We've had people in on Zoom. This will go out on YouTube. But for tonight, to our speaker, and who's also our author, many thanks and good luck with the book. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.